Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org and podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. And we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'm very happy now to welcome Deborah Madison. She is a world-renowned chef. She is the author of many cookbooks, and the newest one is called Seasonal Fruit Desserts from Orchard, Farm, and Market. And she will be at Collected Works Bookstore here in Santa Fe tonight at 6 o'clock. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. It's good to be here again with you.
So this book is about fruit, and it's about not only recipes for fruit, but really this whole phenomenon of what fruits are, what they taste like, and how much has been lost since the advent of industrial farming and supermarket fruit.
Yeah. Well, it's one of the reasons I wanted to do a dessert book was I'm very concerned about fruit. I watch people shop at the supermarket, and I notice that they pick up fruit and they put it in a bag and they don't do this very human thing, which is to bring it to their nose and smell it. Because the smell of fruit tells you whether it's got great promise or whether maybe it started to ferment and it's over the hill. Most likely, there's nothing there in the smell of fruit, which is why people no longer are in that habit. It's like buying fruit is a duty food, you know, because the government tells us we should eat so many servings of fruit and vegetables a day. So people drop it in a bag. They don't smell it. There's nothing to smell anyway. It's a very sad state.
It's not only tasteless, is it also devoid of nutrition?
I mean, intuitively, I want to say yes. I'm not a scientist, and I don't really know that. But, I mean, these are varieties that have been chosen because, one, is they're bright red, and people are very attracted to red. So you see a lot of red peaches, red apricots, red blushed fruits. They're bred to travel, so they're very hard. They don't seem to develop the sugars that are necessary to make that perfume that fruit should have when it's ripe and ready to eat. So whether all the nutrients are there, I don't know, but they've probably been picked before they should.
So what happens is you've got a lot of trees that are bred to have maximum quantities. They're picked before they're ready. But the alternative is something that we have around us, which is farmers markets.
Yes, we do. And you know, this is New Mexico isn't a terrifically great fruit growing area the way other parts of the country are. But we do have a wide spread of fruit. Actually, we have all kinds of cherries at the farmers market. We have various kinds of plums. We're seeing more varieties of apples, including some heirloom apples, pears, strawberries. Now, rhubarb will go through most of the summer once it gets
started.
Which
is technically a vegetable.
Yeah, which is technically a vegetable for sure. it's only a fruit if you add a lot of sugar. blackberries have made an appearance to the market, some raspberries. So we certainly have a spread of fruit, and when we get it at the market, then it's really quite lovely and fresh and flavorful.
One of the things in your book that I found fascinating is that the best fruit-growing areas, I don't even know if I read this right, but what I thought I read was the best fruit-growing areas are irrigated deserts.
Yeah, well, my brother's a fruit grower, so I asked him, what are some of the qualities that make fruit good? And he said, ideally, you'd want to grow fruit in a desert with irrigation because you want the hot days, you want cool nights, and, of course, you need enough water. So Central California, for example, it's not quite a desert, but it's certainly not a moist area. It has limited rainfall. It has very hot days. It has hotter nights. But think of fruit in Israel, which is imported all over the world. That's exactly the condition that's there. Now, not every place has that, and it doesn't mean that good fruit can't be grown. But he's just saying, ideally, that would make the best flavor in fruit.
Now, then, of course, there are tropical fruits.
Oh, yes.
And mangoes and bananas and papayas and guavas, yeah, and things that grow best in just crazy hot human climates.
Yeah, they do. And I actually didn't deal with those fruits so much in this book because I really wanted to look more of what's in our own agricultural areas in this country. And there are some places where mangoes grow, Southern California, where lychees grow, Florida, for example. But I didn't want to really depend so much on imported fruits as making use of what's around us.
Now, This is there's a very sweet passage where you write about limitation being a good thing. It's not necessarily so wonderful to have access to strawberries 365 days a year. There's something really lovely about waiting for strawberries to come into season, buying them locally, and eating really delicious strawberries.
Sure. And I think we've actually figured this out now with tomatoes. And, you know, people commonly say that, oh, good tomato is worth waiting for. Local asparagus is just unbelievable. It's worth waiting for. You have it for a short period of time and it's over. And fruit, perhaps, is even more so that way because it depends so much on being in its season and in its place in order to be at its full potential.
You have a nice story about giving a strawberry to your husband. Tell us that.
Well, Patrick has always maintained that he doesn't like strawberries. And you don't hear people say that very often, that they don't like strawberries. And I was in Southern California doing research for this book. I was at a farmer's market, I think in San Diego, perhaps it was. And there were strawberries that were just so heavenly. They were so delicious. So I bought a quarts of them, as I usually do, and carry them home on the plane. And when I got home, I told Patrick, I said, you know, open your mouth and close your eyes. I'll give you something to make you wise. Well, he was very hesitant to do that, which I think is a very good human response. You know, you don't just close your eyes and put anything in it. But he did, and I put a strawberry in his mouth, and he chewed it, and he asked what it was. He said, "What is this?" I said, "That's a strawberry." So I realized then that when he said he didn't like strawberries, is he didn't like, you know, those big, hollow cored, hard, unperfumed strawberries that we normally consume. He'd never really had a real strawberry.
And many of us, I mean, I haven't had that kind of a strawberry for many years.
No, I haven't either. Although we're getting them now at the farmer's market. I once walked into the farmer's market a few years ago, and I think Don Bustos had some strawberries, and I can remember smelling them and following my nose to them. That's how they should be. They should be that vibrant and that aromatic. And there they were. He had two little baskets of strawberries, and they were divine. And if that's all I have in the season, that's fine.
You have a section in your book, we're talking to Deborah Madison about the book Seasonal Fruit Desserts, about the names of fruits, of the varieties of fruits, and how important it is to know those names.
Oh, it's so important. And I'm thinking about that because, you know, if people go to an orchard stand or they go to a farmer's market and say, for example, they get a Babcock peach, which is just one of the most superlative white peaches, and they have it and they're just insanely in love with it and they go back next year. But if they didn't know what it was called, you know, they're going to say, well, I had a peach here. It was really good.
Right.
You know, let's see. Well, I think it was white flesh, but it had kind of this sort of orange skin, or, you know, people start to try to describe what they've had. And descriptions never, especially if you have someone who's maybe selling five or six white peaches and Arctic nectarines and other, you know, white stone fruits, they're going to say, "Would you think it was this? Do you think it was that?" And it's a guessing game, you know.
Right.
If we don't know what to call things, we can't ask for them again. And if we can't ask for them and build a relationship to them, then I think we're in real danger of losing varieties. We're in terrible danger of losing varieties. They have no fans. They need Facebook pages, you know, so you can go and ask for a Santa Rosa plum or an Alderman or a Shiro or a Babcock peach or a Holstein apple or whatever it is that so struck you one time in your life that you wanted again.
Well, and of course you can't, it's one of the things that you can't share via computer or long distance is the taste of things. You can show a beautiful peach, but you can't show the, I remember when I was a college student, I went to Italy for a semester and I bought a white peach. I'd never seen one before. And I tasted it and I thought, I am eating a peach that mated with a rose, and this is their offspring.
Yeah, and in a way you are, because peaches and roses are in the same family. They're in the rose family. They're very different genera, but you can actually pick up those smells. Sometimes there's a certain rose I love called Playboy, and that rose smells a little like raspberries.
Yes.
And a little like peaches. So they go back and forth between flowers and fruits. You get those similarities, and that gives you a clue, in fact, that a peach might be very nice with little rose geranium syrup, or, you know, something that emphasizes those flavors and brings them together.
Let's talk for a moment about the recipes. There are a lot of recipes in this book. I mean, certainly there are the pies and the crisps and things like that, but there are a lot of them that are really about the fruit with just the most minimal additions of a liqueur or rose water or things like that.
Right, and some of them don't have any additions at all because if you, I really maintain that if you have fine, excellent, wonderful fruit, you don't need to put anything with it. But what you can do is you can make absolutely gorgeous platters of fruits that are in season at the same time. So I give some suggestions for what those platters might be like because we're not necessarily attuned to thinking of those combinations. For example, in the fall, you might have the second crop of figs. You know, you'd still have raspberries. You might have your first few persimmons, and you'd have grapes. And you might have a new crop walnut. I'm also including nuts in this book. You know, so there's an absolutely stunning platter. But beyond the platters, there are very simple things you can do that are just spectacular, like just having a slice of melon with a glass of sweet wine, or yellow doll, yellow flesh watermelon with blackberries. Be beautiful together. Grapefruit, for example, just with a little pomegranate molasses on it.
I mean, this, and that's the thing, grapefruit. When I think of grapefruit, I get little sort of sour reactions on the side of my mouth because it's so sour. Pomegranate molasses suddenly makes it beautiful and edible.
Yeah. And actually, grapefruit is one of those fruits which, if you can ever buy it off a tree, you know, in an orchard or, you know, really close to its source, they're so divine. I mean, they're not bad in the supermarket. Citrus fruit actually does pretty well, but they're even better if you can step outside that and find them close to their source. But I did want to start the book with the most elemental fresh fruit desserts that really depend on the quality of the fruit more than anything. It doesn't depend on pie crust. It doesn't depend on your labor. It doesn't depend on whipped cream or any of that. And then I move from that into compotes. Like, speaking of citrus, there's a compote I love that's sliced oranges of various kinds with a orange caramel. Very easy to make, but it just brings another dimension to the fruit.
What does compote mean?
A compote is usually a fruit in a syrup. And so it may be cooked. It usually is cooked, or in this case, it's a hot syrup over the fruit, which in a way cooks it, but very, very briefly, and leaves its freshness. And of course, it refers to a dish as well, which is usually glass. And holds fruit, and it's a spectacular thing to serve, a beautiful compote.
One of the things that you write about is the many choices we have in sweeteners. It's not just about cane sugar or brown sugar anymore.
No, it's really changed, and it's also now about fair trade sugar, which I'm particularly happy to see because, you know, sugar is one of those crops that doesn't have such a good history vis-a-vis how humans are treated. It's associated with slavery, and we haven't always moved that far away from it. And now there's a possibility of buying fair trade sugar. But in addition to that, I mean, there's so many kinds of honeys. Maple sugar is my absolute favorite sugar to use. You have to find it at a farmer's market if you're not going to buy it in a tiny little container. I mean, I like to buy 10 pounds at a time.
Or right.
I buy that at co-ops in the Midwest, that kind of thing. Agave nectar, some people like those. Stevia. Stevia, because it's liquid, is great if you want to sweeten a compote, for example. Something that's in a sauce and it's a little bit tart, sugar has to dissolve, but an eye drop, you know, of stevia will just bring it right up.
Now, cane sugars and maple sugars and honey are different kinds of sugars. Is stevia a sugar?
I don't think it is because it's an herb.
It's an herb,
yeah.
So it's a sweet herb that people use as a substitute.
Yes, and you have to be a little bit careful with it. Sometimes it can get a little funky taste if you use a lot of it. But I keep a bottle, and I just use it, you know, by a few drops at a time. It's powerfully, powerfully sweet. You can buy seeds for the herbs. You can sometimes buy the herb plants here in Santa Fe.
Really? I've never had it.
Yeah. And if you take a leaf and put it in your mouth, it's very sweet. So the extract is even sweeter.
Very interesting. We're talking to Deborah Madison. So, and of course, each of these sugars, some of them have very little flavor and therefore leave the flavor of the fruit to express itself. Some add their own flavor.
Yes,
that mixes
exactly.
With the fruit.
There's one recipe in this book that has nothing to do with fruit, but there are times of the year when there's not a lot of fruit, and it's a butterscotch pudding. And it's very simple pudding. I mean, it's nothing I have invented. Obviously, it's a cornstarch-based pudding. But if you use that really, really dark, dark brown natural sugar from Wholesome Foods, and you use creme fraiche, the two of those things combined are unbelievable. I mean, it just makes the most delicious dessert. And then I toast a little nut and have crushed pecans or something like that on top, you know. But so the sugar makes a huge difference there. If you made it with white sugar, it would just be a sweet thing. You make it with this really dark, dark sugar, it just blossoms.
That's one of the things I so appreciate about creative professional chefs like you, is that you can put two simple things together and it's a work of art, you know, but you have to know through all of your years of experience what those two things are.
Yeah, and sometimes I see other people do that and I think, oh, that seems so obvious. Why didn't I think of that? What a good idea, you know, but it's true.
There's another one that I saw, a chocolate bark recipe. That doesn't have any fruit in it
either. Oh, it does. It has dried fruit in it.
That's true. Yeah,
it has beautiful raisins and apricots, and it has pistachio nuts and things. So I definitely, this is not a book that's heavy on chocolate. I think there's only three chocolate recipes, but it is heavy on dried fruits and nuts, because during the winter, that's really what we have. And if we don't use those, then we're buying, you know, fruit from New Zealand or something, which doesn't really make any sense. So I wanted to underscore the place of dried fruits. Again, at farmers markets, you can find all kinds of dried fruits that you won't normally see, like in San Francisco and California, all over. I've bought dried nectarines, dried white peaches, pluots, different kinds, red friar plums, black friar plums. These are spectacular in fruit compost. They look like stained glass. They're just beautiful. You know, and so there's quite an extensive dried fruit section, because I think people who are trying to eat locally or to eat food, even if it's been shipped in, we're not talking about highly perishable food. Right. It doesn't have to be on a plane. It just makes a little more sense.
Do you dry your own fruit?
I haven't dried my own fruit. I don't have any stone fruit trees. I just have apple trees and quince. So usually with my apple trees, I make a lot of applesauce and a lot of butter and apple butter, and I freeze the applesauce, and we just opened our last bag. So just in time.
Right. Yeah. Now that it's spring.
Yeah.
Very interesting. The prune industry has apparently changed the name of prunes to dried plums, because they were so associated with,
laxative qualities. I know, only in Europe, you go to Europe, there's none of that association. People are quite happy to call them prunes, because, you know, prunes and plums are slightly different fruits. I mean, they're very closely related, but apparently calling them dried plums has actually helped the industry. I'm kind of against it, but if it helps people to eat the fruit, that's great. But in fact, when we buy dried prunes, they're different than buying all the plums that we see, you know, fresh in the market. They can be dried too, and they have a very different quality than dried prunes. So I like to keep the distinction. But hey, you know, we're not in a culture that likes distinctions. So,
well, and that's the beauty of, as we talked about before, naming not only the fruits but the many varieties of fruits. There's a picture in the book of something called Bronx grapes.
Oh yeah,
what are Bronx grapes?
They're a really lovely, lovely grape, and like a number of the fruits I mentioned in the book, they're on the slow food arc of taste as a food that's superlative quality, but also endangered because people don't know the names, and also they don't ship well. They have I can't remember what the cross is offhand, but they're a beautiful sort of violet green colored grape. They have very thin skin, so when you eat them, they just burst in your mouth.
Are they from the Bronx?
No. It has nothing to do with the Bronx, I don't think. But because of their delicacy, they don't ship well, so you don't see them very often. But I did see them at a farmer's market, and it had a little sign that said Bronx grapes, so I took a picture. It's in the book.
Right.
You know, just because once we talk about it, then you might, if you see a sign in a market that says this is what it is, you might just say, oh yeah, I heard about that someplace. I'll give it a try. They're a really lovely grape.
It occurs to me as you're talking that the distinctions that people are failing to make in the fruit that they eat, they are making in wine. Because, of course, there's so many different varieties of grapes and varieties mm-hmm. of wine, and people are connoisseurs and make all kinds of distinctions.
Yeah, they do. Yeah, that's a very good point. I mean, wine, people can talk endlessly about this slope, that wine, this vineyard, and so this grape,
this year,
and so forth and so on. The same should be able to be somewhat applicable, you know, to fruit. But
do you and your fruitarians?
my plant maniac friends.
do you sit around and talk about fruit in that way?
Well, yeah, there have been those conversations. You know, there's a really great such and such over here. You should try that. You know?
Well, I guess and one of the differences is you can ship wine anywhere,
mm-hmm.
and you can keep it for whenever you mm-hmm. want to drink it, which is not the same as we've been talking about with fruit.
Yeah, I mean, one of the results of that distinction is that, well, we have very few varieties of grapes to choose from in the market. There are fantastic varieties of eating grapes, so many of them. They're not that hard to grow. I mean, they can be growing. This isn't about they can't be growing. But one of the things people won't eat them is because a lot of the best varieties are seeded. And, you know, people have this thing about seeds. What do you do with the seeds? Well, they're little. You know, you just spit them out, throw them on the ground, put them in your pocket. It's not, you know.
Well, and some people eat them.
And some people eat them. It's not a big deal, no matter what you do with them. But we were talking earlier about plums. I mean, when you go to the store this summer, it doesn't matter which store in Santa Fe you go to, you'll pretty much see red plums and black plums.
Right.
This makes me tear my hair out because plums can be golden. Coe's Golden Drop is an absolutely gorgeous plum. They can be red. They can be speckled and russeted. They can be blue. They can be purple. They can be yellow. They can be green. A Kelsey plum is a beautiful green plum with a firm green flesh when it's ripe. There's all kinds of colors. There's all kinds of sizes. They all have their uses. They all have their distinctive personalities and characteristics. But we've reduced everything to red and black. Pretty much.
And they don't even taste good. I mean, I remember the plums from my childhood, which were so deep purple and juicy, and you bite into it, the fruit drips down your chin, and they're so sweet and so delicious and flavorful. I haven't had one of those since probably the 70s.
Yeah, you have to have your own plum tree, pretty much. Or go to a farmer's market where, and you have to, I love the farmer's market because it's where you're going to find the best fruit, but just to say a word of beware, a lot of times farmers want to be the first to have the plums in the market or the first to have the apples or the first for this. And if they pick them too soon and they're green and tart, you're going to be very disappointed. So use your nose, pick up a plum, smell it. See, it should smell like something. Ask for a taste. It should be firm, but it should have a little give. The skins often have tannins in them, so the skins are sharp while the flesh is a little sweeter, and that especially comes through in cooking. But, you know, that can be worked with if it's ripe to start with.
Another thing that you wrote about was that certain fruits have little spots on them, which are good. I mean, we all think spots are worms or bugs, but there are things called sugar spots.
Yeah, yeah. Especially in nectarines, you see those. And when you see that little spot, you know, they're like little tiny pinpricks. I mean, they're not big blotchy spots. They're tiny little spots all over them. It's often a sign. I mean, they're called sugar spots. You know, I think in the trade just because it means, oh, that's a sweet one. You know, they're good. And some fruits are just naturally russeted, or they have that kind of dimpling spotting all over, like a Santa Rosa plum always has those little spots. But a Santa Rosa plum sounds just like the one you were talking about, you know, this red flesh and it's juicy and it's dripping and, oh, it's so delicious.
We're talking to Deborah Madison about her new book, Seasonal Fruit Desserts from Orchard, Farm, and Market. Tell us more about the Slow Foods Ark of Taste. Ark as in Noah's Ark.
Yes, as in Noah's Ark, exactly. The Ark of Taste was started, gosh, about 10 years ago as part of Slow Foods. It's a conceptual idea, in a sense, that has an active component. The idea is that they're wonderful foods that people have enjoyed that have a historical relationship to countries or to people or to you know, areas that have really worthy taste. And if they've been lost or they've almost been lost, and the ARC, the intention of the ARC is to try to get these foods boarded so they don't disappear. So yeah. Some of them, we, for example, the heritage turkeys, that was one of our, that was our first American ARC food. And now it's common. Everybody talks about heritage turkeys, and, you know, there's red bourbons, and there's this, and there's that, and you're going to have one for Thanksgiving. It's become familiar. They're in. It's back in the culture now that it's distinct from, you know, the usual kind of turkey that you're going to get. So there's all kinds of foods that are on the ARC of taste. People can actually recommend a food to be on the ARC of taste. They have to do some research, though, to make sure it should be there. But there they are, and they're wonderful fruits. Pawpaws, for example. Pawpaw is a very common fruit. It grows in 26 states in this country.
I've never even heard of it.
And you've never heard of it. Way down yonder in the pawpaw patch, you might have heard of that song.
Right.
But it's related to the cherimoya, and it's the only subtropical fruit that grows in mainland America. And they used to be just absolutely plentiful. And they're aromatic the way a tropical fruit is. They have that same kind of smell. They have a white, creamy flesh. They're real ugly to look at. They're kind of kidney shaped and blotchy. They're not a sexy fruit. They're not really very appealing, but they grow like crazy, and they used to be eaten a lot. I think the banana probably has in some respects taken their place for that.
Do they have a thick peel like that?
They have a very thick skin. They're a little like a cherimoya, but like a smooth cherimoya. So that's something that could easily be grown here, but we have just forgotten about. There are varieties of strawberries.
Yeah, and then you have to educate people. I mean, you can grow them, but then you have to get people to actually choose them. People don't choose what's unfamiliar.
Well, then you have to have taste education. You have to have give people opportunities to taste these things and to find out about them.
I was thinking while looking at this book and the focus on the quality of the fruit, it reminded me of that Michael Pollan maxim that a food is not a delivery vehicle for individual nutrients. It's a whole food in itself.
Oh,
and
yeah.
There's a very good chance that if you try to break it all apart and break up the nutrients, you're not even going to be able to absorb them anyway.
Well, yeah. I mean, it doesn't. It's always better to eat a whole food. I think that that goes without saying. And that means the skins, you know, as well as the flesh. That's how you're going to get everything. But also, you're going to get pleasure with it. This whole idea, and I so agree with Michael Pollan on this, with nutritionism, of breaking things into components. And that's why you should eat them. That's why people are buying this horrible fruit in the supermarkets, because they've been told they should eat it. If fruit were as good as it could be, they wouldn't have to be told. I'm pretty convinced.
We have, of course, a nice farmer's market here in Santa Fe, and at certain times of year, they're just overflowing with delicious fruit and vegetables and meat and everything. At other times of year, it's a lot slower. Supermarket food, and especially supermarket fruit, as you mentioned, is designed to be shipped a very long distance to the detriment of taste and probably nutrition. What about the natural foods types of stores that we also have that are somewhere, they're sort of halfway between supermarkets and...
Yeah, I think that they're not any better than the supermarket, frankly.
Really?
That's not necessarily true at La Montanita Co-op, because they, I think that they tend to buy more from smaller farmers. I know a lot of the farmers in California that they do buy from, and they're, this is not big organics, ag industrial. You know, these are small farms with farmers who are really building soil, and that's building flavor. But I mean, if you go to our natural supermarkets, you look, they're from California. Everything's from California, or it's very green. It doesn't have aroma. I have to say, I haven't found it to be much different.
Do you eat seasonally yourself? Do you eat foods that are in season more than
that? Yeah, I do. I mean, I'm, as I said, I'm not tempted at all to buy a California strawberry. They just can't. I mean, I would wish they were good. I know in California they're good, but the ones that come here are not. I'm not tempted. I mean, I actually eat far less fruit than I would like to, because most of it's just not very good, really, from the store. Industrial food is not very good.
Let's go back to the recipes. As we talked about, there are many recipes that are very simple, combinations of mm-hmm. fruits, the fruits themselves with a little bit of condiment. But then there are the obligatory pies and pastries. You write something which I thought was great, was the difference between a pastry chef and a cook who makes desserts.
Right.
You being the latter.
Yeah. Well, originally this book was going to be called Desserts for the Pastry Impaired, because I'm kind of pastry impaired. I mean, I can do it, but I don't really enjoy constructing puff pastry and making pastry base very, very architectural, perfect kinds of desserts. I'm a cook, you know. Cooks are a little looser. these are cooked desserts. Fruit lends itself very, very well to that. So, yes, you're right. That's definitely my focus. But actually, what you mentioned is the obligatory pastries. They're all very, very doable, and they're often very good vehicles for fruit. I don't make a perfect pie. I mean, if I make a great looking pie, I'm more amazed than anybody. But a galette that you can roll out into any old shape and put your fruit in and fold over the top, and hey, you know, it's rustic, it looks good. This is not about perfection. And I did include, I included 5 cakes in the book, but I included them because there are times when we want a cake, and certain cakes are very, very nice with fruit. And they really can go through the season. So one of them is an olive oil chiffon cake, which is very high, it's very light, it's seasoned with citrus.
Does it taste like olive oil?
Once you know the cake, you would recognize it, but you wouldn't take a bite and say, gosh, this tastes like olive oil, because it changes when it bakes.
Yeah.
It's very moist and lovely. But that cake, you can take that through the whole year. In the winter, you could have it with dried fruit compotes. You could have it with figs cooked in sherry with a little bay leaf and clove. You could have it in the summer with nectarines poached in syrup with lavender. You could certainly have it with berries. I mean, all these other fruit desserts, they can work as side dishes, or they can be the main thing. So cakes are sometimes a nice vehicle to have a fruit compote or alongside.
Now, cakes are the one thing where you do have to worry a little bit about chemistry and so on, the science of it, because of the very high altitude at which we're living.
Yeah, well, I hope I've taken care of that for you. Things like chiffon cakes, cakes that have a lot of air in them, do really, really nicely at high altitudes. They just soar. One cake is a chocolate cake, but it's steamed. And the steaming makes it incredibly, incredibly moist. You know, it's just absolutely dreamy, you know. And there's a cake with polenta. I use some of the polenta from the farmer's market and almond paste. That is a butter cake, but it's not a big cake. It's a little cake, like a torte. There's some walnut-based cakes, ground nuts, ground pistachios, ground walnuts, egg whites again. They're more classic European torts, but lovely with something like dried cherries that you've cooked in a little red wine, you know, or fresh cherry compote. So this is a kind of mix-and-match book. I mean, there are lots of elements that can be brought together in different ways.
And there's a great focus on using good ingredients, even using good eggs. Good butter, good milk, those kinds of things.
Sure. Why not? you don't want to just have the fruit be good and have everything else be sort of, no.
Well, sometimes, I mean, I'm not, certainly, I don't cook as much as you, well, no one cooks as much as you do, but I don't cook all that much. But sometimes I think, well, eating good butter on bread, you can really tell. But when you put it in a cake, can you really tell?
Well, my feeling about butter is, I use organic butter, like Strauss's organic butter, because fats are where a lot of pesticides and things that we don't want to be ingesting is where they tend to reside. And butter is fat, you know, so I do want to use a good quality butter. I want to use good quality eggs because they taste good. But if I had, you know, a dozen, you know, lesser quality eggs and a dozen really great quality eggs, I think you'd probably get a sense of the flavor more as in a scrambled egg if you use that good quality egg. But all together, everything builds the flavor of of whatever it is you're cooking.
The photographs are very beautiful in this book, Seasonal Fruit Desserts. I have read about food photography, and a lot of times they don't use real food in food photography. Are these all real?
Oh, yeah. They are. That's kind of old idea, actually, I have to tell you. I mean, when the first food photography I ever did was for Family Circle magazine in 1980 or 1981, and they made my peach ice cream out of Crisco and jam. They put shaving cream on top of the... that was really... Yeah. That they did that. It was horrible.
To put it under hot lights and make it look realistic.
Yeah, but I work with a photographer, Lori Smith, who, first of all, she doesn't use lights. And I do all my own styling. I do all my own cooking. These are all done in my house, or my yard, I should say. Some of them were done outside, too. But... I just cook and give her a plate and she takes a picture.
That's fantastic.
It's a lot. I mean, it's a little more complicated than that, but but that's basically how it's done.
The book is called Seasonal Fruit Desserts from Orchard, Farm, and Market by world-renowned chef Deborah Madison. This is the latest of her many, many cookbooks, and she will be at Collected Works tonight, the 6th of April, at 6 o'clock in the evening, and we look forward to seeing you there.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
We're going to take a break right now. We'll be back in a moment. I'm delighted now to welcome author Michael McGarrity. He is, besides being a prolific mystery novel author, is one of the three chartered donors to the Richard Bradford Memorial Creative Writing Scholarship. The awarding of the first scholarship is this Friday, April 9th, from 5:30 on at the Visual Arts Gallery at the Santa Fe Community College. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
It's always a pleasure to be with you, Mary Charlotte. You're looking great. I hope that big smile means you're happy and life is sweet.
Life is sweet. What can I say? But this is a wonderful thing that you and a couple of other donors are doing. Tell us about who Richard Bradford was, that this Memorial Creative Writing Scholarship was named after him.
Richard Bradford grew up in Santa Fe and lived here most of his adult life, with some time out for a college degree and a stint in the Marine Corps, and actually wrote two very wonderful books set in New Mexico. One is Red Sky at Morning, which is a classic coming-of-age tale that is taught in many secondary and college lit classes throughout the country. And a second book, So Far From Heaven, which I think was equally brilliant. So those were his two novels. He did a lot of freelance writing also, and for many, many years wrote a column in El Palacio, the Museum of New Mexico Foundation quarterly magazine, that was filled with humor and wit and just a great take on history, in New Mexico history particularly. He was a dear friend. He was one of the first people, along with Tony Hillerman, to really get behind me in my first debut novel, Tularosa, which came out actually 14 years ago this month, and had just this curmudgeonly charm about him. And many of us old-timers in Santa Fe, been here for a heck of a long time, remember Richard with great affection. And he died some years back from lung cancer. He was a very heavy and chronic smoker. And has never received the recognition that he deserves. I mean, Red Sky at Morning was made into a movie. It was filmed on Sequoia Madre. It's not available on DVD. I haven't been able to find it. I did see it when it came out, and I've seen it several times since. So here's this writer with a great sense of humor, with really incredible intellect, total command of the language, superb ability to tell stories, who some of us didn't want to see forgotten in this community. And what better way to keep his memory fresh than to set up a creative writing scholarship in his name at the community college. So that's kind of the background on how this all got underway.
And so some lucky Santa Fe Community College student is getting a scholarship to study writing.
That's right. He's going to get a scholarship that will cover tuition, books, and fees for a year.
Very nice.
And we hope to make it an endowed scholarship. So part of the thing that we're doing on Friday night at the Visual Arts Center at the Community College is kicking off a fundraising enterprise to try to get to the amount that we've set to have it fully endowed is $50,000. And we're already underway with a good start, but we're really encouraging the community, especially those people who love Richard's work or knew him personally or both, to join us on Friday and celebrate his life and create a legacy in his name.
Has the name of the student been revealed yet?
I do know the name, but I don't know whether I'm at liberty to reveal it or not.
Oh, okay.
Not.
So well, then
I think I'll just let that one slide.
People will have to go on Friday night. Now, you come out with about one book a year, and we had you on talking about your last book, Dead or Alive, which I'm still haunted by. I don't even know if I recommend it, but as we were talking about before we go on the air, it is a book, a cautionary tale, truly about the worst evil that exists in human beings. What are you working on now?
I'm stepping aside from the series, Mary Charlotte.
You are?
I am. I have a contract with Dutton to produce a historical novel set in territorial New Mexico in the 19th century that is basically a prequel to the series and really traces my protagonist in the Kevin Kearney novels, ancestors, and on their journey west into New Mexico and into the ranch land on the Tularosa Basin.
Is somebody named Kearney in it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. But it's set in a different time. And so the language is different. The landscape is different. The storytelling is different. It's opening a whole new door for me as a storyteller. And as a result, I'm moving with much greater caution as I write this book.
I think writing historical fiction is fraught with every kind of difficulty because it's so easy to make mistakes of innumerable kinds.
Yeah, I probably will. I mean, I've yet to write a flawless book, as my very alert readers have a tendency to point out to me when they find an error or a flaw. So, because it is fiction, I'm going to stay as accurate as I can to time and place, but manipulate some things.
What kind of resources do you do to place yourself into the headspace and the language and so on of that time?
Well, I've been basically researching this book for a good decade, and so I have built a library, both visual and print library, that allows me to actually look at what places appeared to be like, as well as visiting them in real time in the current era, but also to read how writers used the language for their characters in earlier times, and then get a feel for all of the little bits and pieces that are kind of interesting about how things look and how people act and how they deal with each other and the language that they use. And giving it that kind of a flavor, I think, comes from all the reading that I've done over the last 10 or more years, plus all those reference books that are piled up on my desk next to my computer.
I suppose you have to walk the line between having authentic language of the time and contemporary language that your readers can easily understand.
Yeah, there's, for example, if you look back over some of the place names for New Mexico, as well as some of the stories that were written in the early 20th century, you will find place names that begin with the N-word. And you'll find people in novels very comfortably using that word. Okay, that word I cannot use that word. You know, I could justify it, I suppose, and say, well, time and place would dictate that this was at that point socially acceptable to say. But I don't think it would work to do it. So there are certain things that you can use, but then there are other things that you have to avoid.
Yeah.
Now, one of the things that I'm trying desperately to avoid is writing a cliche Western. So think about how hard it is, because it's been really hard to actually write a book set in the frontier West in New Mexico during territorial days that isn't filled with every possible literary and visual cliche that we have from the Western mythology.
Right.
You know? And I am I'm smiling as I say this to you, because in a way it's a hell of a lot of fun to try to avoid all those cliches. So far, so good.
Oh, it'll be so interesting to read. I hope it comes out soon. We'll get you back on the air.
Okay.
Well, Michael McGarrity is an author, and once again, he is one of the three chartered donors to the Richard Bradford Memorial Creative Writing Scholarship. And the awarding of the first scholarship is this Friday, the 9th of April at 5:30 at the Visual Arts Gallery at Santa Fe Community College. Thanks so much for being with us.
It's always a pleasure. You know, I want to come back and interview you once.
Lots of luck.
I'm serious. I think Santa Fe would love to have Mary Charlotte on the other side of the microphone talking about who she is and what she does and what she loves and what she's going to do next.
I interview people and I like dogs. The end. We're going to take a break now. We'll be right back. I'm very happy now to welcome Rob Weiner and Olivia Cece. They are students at Santa Fe Prep, and they're here to talk to us about the 30th annual Terry Fox Run, which is happening tomorrow, Wednesday, the 7th of April. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having us.
So who is Terry Fox, and what is this run all about?
Terry Fox was a teenager who lived in Canada, and he was an athlete, a basketball player. And in the year 1980, he got cancer and lost his leg. So he embarked on what he called the Marathon of Hope, running more than 3,000 miles across Canada on one leg. And he became a real activist for just cancer research and fighting through cancer while you're an athlete.
How do you run on one leg?
It's interesting. There's videos of it. It's like a shuffle hop sort of, so it'd be... It's like skipping, really, on one foot.
With a crutch or a prosthetic of any kind?
He had a prosthetic leg, but it was... All the power, obviously, was coming from his good leg, so it was kind of just like a shuffling across.
Amazing.
Really was.
So what does this look like here in town?
Well, what we've been doing for the past 30 years, a teacher at our school actually, after Terry's leg was amputated, he got cancer again. And as he was in the hospital, my math teacher and his son were so touched by the story, they decided to telephone him and ask, you know, what can we do for you, Terry? You've been such an inspiration to us. And he told them, continue my run. Because it's not just my run, it's all of our run. And a few days after that, Terry died. And so for 30 years, we've been putting on this run at La Escuela Andrinas. And students at the Santa Fe Prep Middle School just go collect pledges throughout town. And they go out and run as much as they can. So someone will pledge, say, $1 for every mile so-and-so runs. After that, we collect how many miles each person's run, mail out the pledges, and money goes back to our endowment with the Santa Fe Community Foundation. Currently around $300,000.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
And that goes toward research?
This is helping local families of children affected by cancer.
Uh-huh. Now, Olivia, are you a runner?
More of a sprinter than a long-distance runner, but I ran in the Terry Fox Run the last 2 years.
And so you are both an organizer of this and a participant?
Well, I'm just an organizer this year. When I was in middle school, I'm a freshman now, so when I was in middle school, I ran.
And what about you, Rob?
I think I'm supposed to be helping out with aid station and oranges, but I'm going to have to get some laps in there. Always do one for Terry.
So if people want to participate in this, either as runners or probably more likely as sponsors of people running, how do they do that?
There's a couple ways. We're always accepting donations if you write a check just to Terry Fox Run and then mail it just to Santa Fe Prep, address 1101 Camino de Cruz Blanca, Santa Fe, and then just say, attention, Terry Fox Run. That'll go into our endowment with the Community Foundation. Also, if you know any kids at Santa Fe Prep, you can pledge them to run. It's another easy way to do it.
Is it only prep kids who are running, or you've got other kids from the other schools in
this
town?
This year, it's just prep kids, but because it's the 30th, I mean, it's kind of a big one because this is our math teacher. He's retiring after this year. And so former Governor Jerry Abadaka was at the first run, and he was the honorary starter. And so we're getting to come back for this run. So, and there's going to be some prep alums from the past run. So this year is going to be including more than we have in, say, the past two or three.
Rob Weiner and Olivia Cece are students at Santa Fe Prep. And once again, the 30th annual Terry Fox Run is tomorrow, the 7th of April. Thanks to you both so much for being here.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. Take care.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe radio cafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. My email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, jazz. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, we'll see you tomorrow.